Blog Talk Radio.
This is Mark Galar, and you're listening to Global Cooling Radio. My guest today, Lord Monckton. Lord Monckton, welcome to the show.
Well, Mark, it's a real pleasure to be with you.
Oh, we're really excited about this. It's a chance to talk to people all over the globe, over the Internet at one time. But it's been an interesting week as far as global warming is concerned. In the last week or so, we've learned that Phil Jones and the crew at East Anglia did nothing wrong, that anyone who disagrees with Greenpeace is in the pay of Koch Industries, and that if you want to drill offshore, that's just fine with Barack Obama. So a whole lot happening in this last week. But let's go back to the decision regarding Phil Jones. Are you surprised by that?
Not in the least, because one has to remember that parliamentary inquiries are set up to exonerate Parliament, first and foremost. That's their purpose. And and Parliament in Britain has drunk more deeply of the global warming Kool-Aid than anyone else around the world, and by the largest majority in the 1,000-year history of Parliament, the Climate Change and Economic Suicide Act was passed in October 2 years ago, on the very night when the first October snow for 74 years was falling in Parliament Square outside. And of course, the revelations which have piled one on top of another in the last 6 months or so, that the ClimateGate emailers had been doctoring, tampering with, and hiding, and eventually destroying data to stop other people verifying their questionable results, combined with the endless revelations about the failures of the IPCC, the UN's climate panel, to get any of its elementary science right, the revelation, for instance, that the Himalayan glaciers are not going to disappear by 2035, they meant 2350, and in fact they aren't going to disappear by then either, the revelation that 40% of the Amazon isn't going to disappear immediately because of global warming, the revelation that the increase in sea ice in the Antarctica is statistically significant when the UN's climate panel had tried to pretend it wasn't. These multiple blows to the credibility of the climate extremist official point of view had been causing members of Parliament some concern. So the intention behind the whitewash was to say, well, all is well, really, and all we'll do is slap the University of East Anglia a little bit on the wrist for not having made data available to all those terrible climate sceptics, while entirely understanding that having to supply data to climate sceptics is a vexatious and tiresome thing to have to do. And so it was an extraordinary report by the committee, but I might have written it on day one. I knew that was what they were going to find. After all, they had refused me the right of testifying either in writing or in person, even though I am named repeatedly in those emails, and in circumstances which raise many doubts about what Phil Jones and his colleagues were up to. They were determined only to have witnesses who would give them the answers they wanted to find. And so it wasn't a genuine inquiry, and indeed the same problem is now going on with the East Anglia inquiry, because I tried to write to the chairman of that, Neil Russell, saying I wanted to give testimony, and again I got no reply, so I wrote again and they said, well, maybe they might or they might not, but they weren't really sure. And so all of this, it's clear that they're stacking it in such a way that anyone who wishes to make noises they don't want to hear is excluded from the process. And so, of course, they came to the opinion that Parliament had not got it wrong in voting to shut down the economic activity of Britain over the next 50 years. And the bottom line is that in common with the governing class in most other places around the world, the governing class in Britain finds global warming expedient as a means of raising taxes and increasing regulation, and therefore of doing what politicians like doing best, which is to save us from ourselves at our expense.
I'm not sure what happened. It seems like whenever Al Gore refused to let you testify here in the United States, now there seems to be this pattern of people not wanting Lord Monckton to testify. I believe you told us before that you had actually landed in the United States and found out moments after you got off the plane that you would not be allowed to testify. So it seems like people are running from the truth all over the globe whenever it comes
to... Yeah, this was 6 months ago.
Yes.
When the Republican... ranking minority member on the Energy and Commerce Committee of the House of Representatives had invited me to reply to testimony which he had heard Al Gore was going to be giving the following week. I jumped straight on a plane. By the time I landed, the invitation had been withdrawn by the Democrats, who control the committee, of course, as they have the majority in the House for the time being. And this is the first time in the history of Congress that the First Amendment right to free speech has been denied to the chosen witness of the ranking minority member of a committee of the House of Representatives. So it caused an enormous constitutional crisis. There was a huge row about it. And, of course, it got headlines all around the world. And Al Gore has more or less been in hiding since then, because everybody now knows that he doesn't even dare face a mere potty peer with no scientific qualifications, who is prone to make stuff up, etc., etc., read any Russian blog you like. And if he doesn't even dare to face me, and I am as useless and bad as all the left-wing blogs say I am, then it shows what the collapsing state of this collapsing scare really is.
Ah. Well, I want to let you know that there are a number of people at the ClimateGate Country Club, which is a little online networking site that I've put together, who just wanted me to express their gratitude to you for everything that you've done to try to get the truth out on this matter. It seems like everywhere you go, they're throwing up roadblocks, but you're relentless. You keep going. You have the tenacity of a bulldog. And it's something that's certainly noticed. And even on efforts where they effectively block you from testifying, it's certainly appreciated that you've made the effort. And
of course, every time they do, it's very sweet of you to say all those things, which are totally unjustified. But what is interesting is that every time they try to block the testimony of somebody like me, because I'm not the only one they do this to, obviously, the more it enters into their own souls that what they're doing has no scientific basis for all that they claim a so-called consensus. It, you know, the science is not there. Paper after paper after paper in the peer-reviewed literature is now addressing the question that I first addressed in my own peer-reviewed paper of June 2008 in Physics and Society, called Climate Sensitivity Reconsidered, where I asked the one question which really matters, is how much warming will you get from a given increase in CO2 concentration? Of course, you will get some. That's been settled science for 200 years. The question is, how much will you get? And the answer turns out to be remarkably little. And once I had dared to say it, and had got it published in a reviewed journal, of course, the first reaction of the climate extremists was to say, well, the journal should never have printed my paper. It wasn't peer-reviewed. Of course, it was by a very eminent professor of physics. And that in any case, anything Monckton says must be wrong because he's just a potty peer, dot, 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 dot. But in fact, that paper did open the floodgates because suddenly people in all directions began realizing just how rickety the entire scientific basis for the notion that CO2 has a major effect on global temperature actually is. And as a result, a flood of papers is now appearing. They seem to come out just about every week, showing that at every point in the atmosphere, the measurements do not in any way match up to what the models are trying to predict. These computer games written by little vitty teenagers with their Xbox 360s to be able to predict the climate, which we've known since 1963 you can't do because the climate is a mathematically chaotic object. It's well beyond our scope, well beyond our capacity to model it or predict it more than a few weeks at a time. And of course, when I started saying that, there was the usual stunned silence from the left as they realized it was a point they'd never come across before. And then they regrouped and said, oh, yes, but of course the climate and weather are not the same. And of course, if you then refer them to their own Bible, which are the holy books of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the UN Climate Panel, in 2001 they say that because the climate is a coupled, complex, chaotic, non-linear object, you can't make long-term predictions of future. Do they say weather? No. They say future climate states. And then having said they can't do it, they spend the rest of that report and the whole of the next one doing exactly what they admit can't, in fact. And what is now happening is that people who actually measure the climate, rather than making Xbox 360 or PlayStation models of the climate, are finding that the measurements that they take do not in any way agree with the models. And what is interesting is that every single measurement that gets written up in the peer-reviewed literature is pointing to the fact that the models are exaggerating climate sensitivity. It never goes the other way. These papers all show that there's been an enormous exaggeration of climate sensitivity. It could be at least double, it could be fourfold, it could even be tenfold, depending on which paper you read. But it's now more or less the consensus among the literature on climate sensitivity, on this special subject that's right at the heart of the whole question, that climate sensitivity is low. There's a formidable paper by Lindzen and Choi in 2009, where Dick Lindzen, the Alfred P. Sloan Professor of Planetary and Atmospheric Sciences at MIT, we're not talking of, you know, recently graduated doctors here, or potty peers with no scientific knowledge either. We're talking about one of the most eminent climatologists in the world, and he has concluded, and he's just revised his paper and is about to publish a new version of it to respond to various criticisms that the usual climate gate suspects have tried to make. He's concluded that by direct measurement of the relationship between changes in temperature at the surface and changes in the amount of radiation escaping the space at the top of the atmosphere measured by satellites, we can directly calculate climate sensitivity to be something between a quarter and a fifth of the UN's central estimate. In other words, you're looking at well below 1 Celsius degree or 2 Fahrenheit degrees for a doubling of CO2 concentration, and that's what might happen by the end of the current century, in 100 years' time. So basically, there isn't anything to worry about with the climate. This is now known, it is proven, paper after paper has established this, and still the UN goes on and on churning out these useless models which were proven in 1963 to be forever defective because we can't know the initial state of the climate at any given chosen moment to a degree of precision, anything like sufficient to make reliable predictions of how this chaotic object will unfold in the very long term. The very long term with the climate means more than a few weeks ahead.
Well, let's take our first caller. We have Leighton from San Antonio, Texas. And let's see if I can bring him on. Are you there? Caller, are you there? No, let's try again.
Hello?
Hello, yes, you're on the air. What's your question for Lord Monckton?
Great. Hello, Lord Monckton. I was with you in Copenhagen.
Oh, is that Leighton Stewart?
Yes, it is. Thank you, sir.
Oh, well, I've been talking about your presentation ever since. Just to give the listeners a background here, Leighton Stewart and I attended a series of conferences in Copenhagen on the fringe of the main conference that eventually collapsed. Our conferences did not collapse. We had a very good meeting in particular, for instance, in the Copenhagen Parliament, and the Speaker of the Parliament attended practically the whole day, as did many other members of it. And Leighton Stewart, who is now on the line, gave a very distinguished presentation on why CO2 is good for plants. If we were to double the CO2 concentration, for instance, Leighton Stewart said, you'll get something like a 40% increase in the yield of some staple crops. So this is a very interesting caller. Leighton, fire away with your question.
Well, my question is, what can we do legally to stop the EPA and the president from jamming all of these regulations right down our throat? Will the legal proceedings stop that until it is ultimately settled?
Yes, I think the legal proceedings will stop the EPA. There are two separate strands of legislative activity going on at the moment, and I'll discuss each of them in turn in the US. First of all, there is the EPA's proposal to regulate various forms of transport under the Clean Air Act. They have the power granted to them by Congress to do that. However, There are some formidable problems with the EPA's proposal to regulate. And let's go through just some of them. First of all, they're basing their proposal to regulate on what they call a technical support document, which is so full of lamentable, childish scientific errors that it forms no basis for the rational decision on policy. And they are, I know, because I've seen and indeed assisted in the drafting of several affidavits in the various cases that have now been consolidated into one from various state attorneys general and other parties to try and stop this nonsense. And they've made a number of mistakes. For instance, they reproduce without any criticism a graph from the IPCC's 2007 report, which shows a considerable increase in the rate of warming over the last 100 years, which in fact hasn't taken place. It was a statistical artifact of a bogus technique that they were using to compile the graph. And they'd been told about that, the EPA, and they persisted in that and many other errors. But one of the biggest flaws in the EPA's approach is that they have decided to rewrite the Clean Air Act unilaterally and say that because it's administratively inconvenient to try to regulate everyone who emits 250 tons of CO2 or more, they'd like to raise the threshold to 25,000 tons. Now, that, of course, is a discrimination against the larger emitters, which the framers of the legislation had not intended. And there is no power for the EPA to tailor its decisions on regulation in that way. And the Supreme Court is going to have to strike down that provision. There's a still wider constitutional problem, I think, which is that the EPA itself has been given powers to legislate effectively, and yet Article 1, Section 1 of the United States Constitution vests all legislative powers herein granted in a Congress of the United States, which shall consist of a Senate and a House of Representatives, full stop. There is no suggestion that the EPA or any other executive agency of government should ever be given or have any right to legislate whatsoever. And so I think that now that for the first time the EPA is going to try to legislate under this act, I think it is open to those affected by it to challenge the EPA on the constitutionality of Congress having given it powers which Congress has no power to give it under your Constitution. So there are many very fundamental challenges at every level, the scientific level and at the constitutional level, and also at the economic level to all of this, because the economic case is very clear. Even if you believe, as I don't, the warming effect of CO2 is as large as the UN says it is, then you would have to shut down the entire world economy for, I think it's 41 years before you would forestall just one Celsius degree of temperature increase. Well, plainly, that amount of catastrophic economic damage for that little a climatic benefit makes no sense at all. So for economic as well as scientific and constitutional reasons, I think the EPA's initiative is doomed. And for political reasons, I think that the second piece of legislation we need to talk about, which is the Waxman, Markey and Kerry Boxer bills, is also doomed to failure. I think they'll now only be able to get a very damp squib of a tame cut-back bill through the Senate. That will then have to go back to the House, and by the time it gets back to the House, they'll be very close to the midterm elections. And I don't think the House is going to commit a second time the kind of electoral harakiri that it committed when it voted for the so-called health care bill, which of course was really all about the nationalization and communization of 20% of the US economy. They're not going to try and do that to another 20%. They know perfectly well that if they do, that will doom the Democrats to permanent political extinction.
Thank you for that excellent summary.
A Leighton, real pleasure, Leighton. Very good to hear.
Leighton, love to have you on as a guest at some point in the future to discuss the benefits of CO2.
Great. I'd be happy to do that.
And fantastic.
They've actually invited me to come talk to the International Climate Conference in Chicago, and I look forward to seeing you there.
I'll see you there and look forward to your talk again. It'll be great fun catching up, Leighton. All the very best.
Our next call is from Kendall in Connecticut.
I faxed Henry Waxworks when you were denied the ability to testify. I thought that was a travesty. But my question is, I just wish you would address this whole issue of the fact that the CO2 equals warming thesis, which is contradicted by most of the 20th century's experience, and yet these alarmists have focused on a brief period between the late 70s and the late 90s when they were in a correlation, but of course, you know, that doesn't prove causation. And, you know, I call these people presentists because they're so focused on the what's happening right now, and they think that it shall always be that way. Just wish you'd address that whole issue of CO2.
Right. The question really is about how much warming you get if you increase the CO2 concentration. Now, it is settled science that you will get some. We have to be fair and go along with the extremists when they say that it's been known for a couple hundred years that CO2 causes warming. Yes, it does. But the scientific debate, as you have rightly spotted in your question, is about how much warming it causes. Now, let's take the period you mentioned from the late 70s until 2001, which was a period of quite rapid warming at a rate of 0.16 Kelvin or around 2.5 Fahrenheit per decade. Now, the first thing that I would ask on looking at that rapid rate of warming is we've got a 160-year instrumental temperature record. Have we seen a similar warming rate to that one before? And the answer is yes, we have. Between 1860 and 1880. And okay, that's a long time ago, and the records were a bit uncertain. So was there a more recent one? Yes, there was. And by now, the records were quite reliable. And those were between 1910 and 1940. So in fact, we have three exactly parallel rates of warming, all of them at 0.16 Kelvin per decade, I should say. And they were 1860 to 1880, 1910 to 1940, and 1975 to 2001. Now, the first two periods of rapid warming, and these are the most rapid periods of warming in the instrumental record, the first two of those three periods, 1860 to 1880 and 1910 to 1940, cannot on any view have been caused to any significant or measurable degree by human CO2 emissions because we weren't emitting anything light enough at the time to cause rapid warming. So the question arises then, is the third rate of warming any higher than the other two? Does it show some influence from the extra CO2, which at least in theory, if you believe the UN's exaggerated view of how much warming CO2 can cause, at least in theory, that third period could have been affected by us. But no, it doesn't seem it was affected by us because the temperature increase over that period of around 26 years is no greater than it was in the 20 years, 1860 to 1880, or the 30 years, 1910 to 1940. So let us then examine this most recent period. Let's play the presentist's game, as you call it, and let's have a look at what might have caused this rate of warming. We can't tell what caused the previous two, though we know it wasn't CO2. The question is, what caused this rate of warming? And here, but we've had satellites since about the early 80s watching the atmosphere, and so we're able to tell what caused that warming. And between roughly 1983 and 2001, that's a period of 18 years and a couple of months, we've had satellites watching, and what they showed was that over that period, there was quite a significant, naturally occurring reduction in cloud cover worldwide, allowing an extra sort of 1.5 to 2 watts per square meter of radiant energy to reach the surface that otherwise would have been reflected harmlessly back into space by the clouds. Now, that extra 1.5 to 2 watts per square meter is so large that it's equivalent to the entire warming effect that humanity has had since 1750, and it happened just in a period of 80 years. And it's also quite easy to work out what that means in terms of temperature. It means that the whole of the temperature increase between 1983 and 2001, which was about a third of a degree Kelvin, is accounted for by that naturally occurring reduction in cloud cover. And in doing that calculation, I have allowed for the fact that the original data on which the analysis of the reduction in cloud cover was based were defective in that insufficient allowance had been made for degradation in the orbit of the satellite. That's now been corrected for. Even allowing for that, We now know that all of the warming over that period, and in fact fractionally more than half the warming since 1950 as a whole, was caused by that naturally occurring reduction in cloud cover. So how much room does that leave for CO2 to have caused any warming over that period you're looking at? Well, the answer is it doesn't leave very much. You would certainly have to divide climate sensitivity, i.e. the warming effect of CO2, by approximately 2. You'd have to halve it at the very least. And so that's why we had that warming, which of course stopped in 2001. And why did it stop? Because the cloud cover, following some natural process we don't fully understand, it might be connected with cosmic rays, as Henrik Svensmark and many others have hypothesized. We don't really know, but we do know that it happened. Back came the cloud cover, and what has happened since 2002? There has been rapid and significant global cooling.
Great. Thank you.
You're very welcome.
And next we have Adrian calling from England, and he also has a question that is, actually this does not pertain to CO2, but he has a question about why everyone seems to believe in global warming, and let's bring him on.
Good afternoon.
Hello, Adrian.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. I was impressed by an article in the Climate Fraud News last December by a sixth grader in the United States who, I guess that means he's about 11 or 12. Using the GISS figures, he took pairs of weather measuring stations 100 kilometers apart at similar latitudes, one urban and one rural, throughout the whole of the United States. And using, again, just the GISS actual figures themselves, he plotted from 1900 to 2010, or almost, he plotted the temperatures. And he found that while the urban temperatures did indeed rise, the rural ones didn't. And
yes,
that impressed
me. That's a very good question.
That's a very good question.
And yeah. Sorry, did you finish?
Lord Monta, let me throw something in. We might get a voiceover from Blog Talk Radio saying that the show has ended. We can actually take this show over to an hour, so if a voice comes on that says the show has now ended, everyone ignore it. We're going to stay here until all the questions are answered. So go ahead.
Okay, that's wonderful. Right. To answer your question there, this sixth grader has done what many others have done, and it's a very good piece of research. And what it demonstrates, and there have been many, many surveys demonstrating exactly the same thing, is that the GISS in particular has been extremely poor, as all of the terrestrial data sets have been, at measuring what is called the urban heat island effect, which distorts the rate at which temperatures appear to have increased over the last century in areas which have been rapidly urbanized, and the temperature thermometer stands in the same place, and then what was an open field is suddenly a busy city, and that makes a huge difference to the temperature readings. Now, they are supposed to make an adjustment to try to allow for that, but other research, notably by Dr. Joseph DeLeo, has demonstrated that particularly NASA GIS, which is run by James Hansen, who has a political stake and a financial one in trying to promote this, what they have done is they've actually increased the rate of warming rather than reducing it in urban areas, thereby leading to a very considerable overstatement of 20th century warming as a whole, an overstatement which has also increased over the years because they have tampered to a greater extent with the data in recent years. There's no basis for doing so because the data they're tampering with recent years is from anything up to 100 years ago. So what we are looking at is the fact that you can no longer rely on any temperature record, any global temperature record, going back in time earlier than 1980. From 1980 onwards, we have the satellites which measure global temperatures reliably and largely free of the heat island effect, and they are giving us what is much more likely to be an accurate record of temperature, and it's already noticeable that that record of temperature is diverging and falling below the increases in temperature shown since 1980 by the terrestrial data sets. And I think it's probably fair to say that most meteorologists and climatologists now no longer take the previous central temperature record as a serious record. They now rely only on the satellites, and I think we have to accept that for the rest of the 20th century, we don't know whether or to what extent, if at all, there has been any global warming in the world.
Well, you just confirmed my own opinion that I'm of the firm belief that there has been pretty well no global warming. And if there has been no global warming, then the notion that we're looking for a cause for something that doesn't exist just makes the whole project so farcical, it beggars belief.
Well, this is the extraordinary thing. What, at the very least, we can say this, that there is plainly nothing in the temperature record to suggest that either the absolute value of global temperature or the rate at which it has increased, even if the instrumental record from the surface were correct, there's nothing in that record to suggest we've got anything to worry about. If we go back in the history of temperature, let's go back 300 years. You go back to 1695, at the end of what was called the Maunder Minimum, when the sun had just been through a 70-year period when it was less active than at any previous period in the previous 11,000 years. Well, at that time, from 1695 until 1745 in central England, temperature rose, and this is quite a good proxy for global temperature at that time, temperature rose by 2.2 Celsius degrees or 4 Fahrenheit degrees, compared with just 0.7 Celsius degrees or 1.3 Fahrenheit degrees in the whole of the 20th century. And that even if you believe the probably exaggerated instrumental temperature record from the surface. So we can see, therefore, that there was 6 or 7 times the warming rate occurring before the Industrial Revolution even began that has occurred since. So there's nothing unusual in today's temperatures. We know that the medieval warm period was warmer than the present, though there have been determined efforts by certain climate extremist factions to try to suggest otherwise. The vast majority of the literature using proxy temperature reconstructions shows very plainly that global temperatures were warmer, and it was global in the medieval warm period than they are today. You can go to interesting places like Amiens Cathedral, and you can look up there in the stained glass windows, and you can see them growing vines around Amiens. You couldn't grow vines around there today, and they still don't. It's too cold, but they could when the cathedral was built in the Middle Ages. And likewise, the Roman warm period, the Minoan warm period, and the Holocene climate optimum, that's about 2,000, 4,000, and 6,000 years ago, respectively. All of those periods, particularly the Holocene climate optimum, were substantially warmer than the present, so much so that most of the last 11,400 years have been warmer worldwide than the present. And if you go to each of the last 4 interglacial warm periods, they were considerably warmer than the present. Indeed, the most recent one, 125,000 years ago, then the Eemian warm period, that was anything up to 6 Celsius degrees or 10 Fahrenheit warmer than today. So you look at the temperature record, go back 600 billion years, if you like. For most of that time, global temperatures were around 12.5 Fahrenheit warmer than they are today. There is nothing in the least special or exceptional or unusually high about today's temperatures. Indeed, the only thing that's unusual about them is how ordinary they are.
Thank you very much. May I ask one follow-up question to that?
Please do. Please do. We have the time now. We've taken on an extra 30 minutes.
Okay.
So go ahead.
Okay. Just very quickly. I'm delighted to see that we're in agreement that there has been little or no warming, and what little there is could very well be beneficial. That's wonderful. I've always felt that, and I still do. I read a lot about the subject. I can't understand is how some of the most powerful people in the world who get to the highest office, people like Angela Merkel, Gordon Brown, the President of the United States, Barack Obama, how they've all fallen for the propaganda. I can understand how the professors and the researchers and whatnot are all scrabbling for funding for their various pet projects and whatnot, and they feel they have to toe the official line, and if you come up with a dissenting voice, you're probably not going to get your funding and whatnot. I can understand at that level how they could move in the wrong direction. But how about these people who have the power over billions of dollars and pounds and marks or euros, and how come they fall for it? I just don't understand.
They fall for it because it is socially convenient, politically expedient, and financially profitable. None of the people you mentioned, Merkel, Obama, Brown, etc., none of them has any relevant scientific qualification. They have merely found this argument expedient, as all sides in the UK Parliament have found it expedient, just to go along with this nonsensical scare, because it greatly reduces the freedom of the individual and enhances the wealth and power and reach of government. And as you know, the history of constitutional development has been a battle between the governing class, which is endlessly wanting to increase its power, wealth, and reach, and the governed, who wish to diminish it so that they themselves can be free to get on with their own lives without interference from government. And in that battle, there's no doubt that the global warming chimera has been a magnet for those who want to extend the powers of government. And so we are in you could almost say we are engaged in a great civil war, testing whether our nations or any nation conceived in liberty and dedicated to the principle that all men are created equal, can long endure, if I may paraphrase the Gettysburg Address a little bit. The fact is, this is a battle for freedom that we're fighting here as much as anything else. And we're having to fight it with scientific weaponry against a scientific community which itself has a vested interest in the diminution of the people's freedom, so that it itself can be enriched and empowered. And this is a very big problem with modern society, which could only have arisen if educational standards had fallen in three very material respects. First of all, science is no longer properly or objectively taught. It's taught now almost as a subset of politics in schools. Secondly, religion is no longer taught in schools, and therefore the moral desirability of ascertaining what is the objective truth, rather than seizing upon an expedient point of view and peddling that because it's convenient and profitable, that is no longer taught. And finally, and this is something which is dear to my heart because I was one of the last to go through what one might call the medieval trivium, the three subjects that used to be taught before you could even go to university, which were rhetoric, logic, and grammar. And nobody these days is taught any of those three properly. In particular, they're not taught logic. And that means that these bogus scientists and climate extremists and environmental nincompoops can come forward and they can say, oh, but there is a scientific consensus, as though that were a scientific argument. And of course, it was recognized at once by anyone who'd been told what the Aristotelian logical fallacies were, as the argumentum ad populum, the headcount fallacy. Just because a lot of people say they believe a thing to be true doesn't mean they believe it to be true, still less that it actually is true. Likewise, they say, oh, but you have to respect all these respected scientific august institutions. Nope, that's the argumentum ad verecundia, the argument from reputation. Just because an outfit has a good reputation, even if it deserves it, which it may or may not do, doesn't mean that it's acting in accordance with its reputation. Likewise, they say, oh, but what about all those cuddly bears, therefore global warming is a problem? The cuddly polar bears, that's the argumentum ad misericordia, the argument from pity. Just because we feel sorry for the polar bears doesn't mean that they're threatened by global warming. Even if they were, it doesn't mean the global warming is caused by us. Then they say, oh, but the temperature has been rising, and this is therefore an indication that we are guilty of global warming. Nope, that's the argumentum ad misericordia. The argument, not the misericordia, sorry, that's the argumentum ad ignorantia, the argument from ignorance. We don't know why the warming is happening, so we'll blame it on whatever we feel like, in this case, humanity. Now, what is interesting is I've just gone through all of the major arguments that the other side put forward to to try and suggest that we've got a problem. Every single one of these arguments, whether or not they have any scientific basis, are illogical arguments. And anyone who had been classically trained, looking at the way this debate is conducted and the principal arguments produced by the climate extremists, would have to say that they have not yet, in logic, established anything of a case at all.
If you're not careful, you'll have us all believing that these people are not up to the job. But thank you very much for all your comments. I really enjoyed listening to you.
You're very welcome.
Lord Monkton, I have a question for you. I was watching the interview between that Stuart Varney of Fox News was doing with Ed Begley Jr. And when Stuart Varney began discussing, the fact that people would have to subject themselves to an energy audit if cap and trade went through, and the amount of extra money people would have to pay, I think, in terms of electricity costs per year, the first thing that Ed Begley came back with is, you're using the typical tactic against us. You're using scare tactics. Now, I had to laugh at that, because whenever I took a look at the tactics being used by Team Green, I saw nothing but scare tactics. I saw a poster on treehugger.com of a little girl standing on a block of ice with a noose around her neck, and the message was, when the global warming melts the ice, the little girl dies. In the United States, we've seen the Build-A-Bear people actually run a television special where they used Santa Claus to scare children about global warming. And I also managed to find on Treehugger magazine a commercial that was running in the UK of a father that was reading his little girl to sleep and scaring her to death about all of the doom and gloom that would come with global warming. And so it made quite a bit of sense to me when I saw a study that was done in the UK that found that children were in fact suffering from sleep disorders, or that the sleep disorders were on the rise due to fears over global warming. So I'm just wondering if you could take a minute and sort of speak to what's going on in the UK in terms of what the children are being bombarded with to the point that they would be suffering sleep disorders as a result of this.
Well, in the UK, there has been a series of entirely mendacious advertisements by the government, plainly addressed to children. Exactly as you say, the parent reading the scare story to the child in bed and the child looking terrified. And this has been, it's been the subject of, I think, 930 complaints to the Advertising Standards Authority by members of the public outraged at the inaccuracies contained in the advertisements by the government, which of course has drunk deeply of the Kool-Aid on this. And the Advertising Standards Authority has upheld those complaints, and those advertisements have now been banned, not on the ground that they terrified children, but on the ground that they were completely inaccurate and had no basis in science. So slowly but surely, even the governing class is beginning to become divided on this, and those whose job it is to make sure that the truth and nothing but the truth is told, such as the High Court when reviewing Al Gore's sci-fi comedy horror movie, and the Advertising Standards Authority when reviewing the government. And that these organizations are now beginning to say, well, one side is telling the truth, and that's the skeptical side. The other side, plainly, is telling lies and then exaggerating the lies. And that is not tolerable. So I think that slowly, even among official classes, the truth is beginning to get through. The penny is beginning to drop. And you're quite right. I mean, the scare tactics that have been deployed by the Green Movement, the threat of the disappearance of polar bears, the threat that sea level would rise and wipe out cities. You only have to watch Al Gore's movie to see a series of deeply irresponsible and entirely unscientific scares being presented. And he's now set up an enormous network in which he teaches people to go around spreading these scare stories.
Right.
Now, he is profiting by doing so because he has a financial investment house. Based in the UK, because it would be illegal in the US, and he is profiting by telling these lies. And he's telling these lies and continuing to tell them, and his film is continuing to be shown, even though the High Court in the UK has pointed out that in at least 9 very serious cases, and there's another 30 odd that I've found, Gore is simply telling lies. Now that is a criminal offence. It's racketeering, that's what it is. And eventually, Gore and many others like him are going to face prosecution for having taken money off people in the name of so-called green investments. all of which, you may like to know, are absolutely going through the floor in value because none of them are worth the paper they're printed on. The Church of England's, what's it called, the Church Commissioners of the Church of England, they were taken for $200 million of their investments by Al Gore, and they're going to lose the lot. But hey, what do I care? I'm a Catholic.
I noticed that we began the interview by discussing some of the problems with the UNIPCC report, and you've just pointed out the nine errors in Al Gore's film, or that there, in fact, are nine errors in Al Gore's film that were found by a UK court. Now, together, this UNIPCC 2007 report and Al Gore's film shared a Nobel Peace Prize. And I have to say that when you combine that with the fact that Barack Obama was given a Nobel Peace Prize for approximately 6 days' worth of work on the job, does or the Nobel Peace Prize have any credibility left in the world?
Well, I think it was best summed up by a diner in Texas, which in those huge plastic letters you can fit onto a board outside its shop advertising the wares. It simply said this: free Nobel Peace Prize with every order of taco chicken.
I had not seen that, and I'm in Texas, so that's absolutely hysterical. Do you have time to answer just a couple more questions?
Yes, of course.
Okay, fantastic. This question comes from Scott. He emailed it to us from Montreal, Canada, and he wants to know, what is it going to take to finally break the hockey stick so that no one else can pull it out as proof? And I understand what he means, because in green circles, there is absolutely no admission that there is anything wrong with Michael Mann's hockey stick graph. You hear things like, well, it had a couple of minor errors, but those have been corrected. Is there anything that you think will ever bust up the hockey stick? I know McIntyre and McKittrick did a great job. But
well, interestingly, the IPCC 2007 report unwittingly does the job for us, because it presents a new version which incorporates Michael Mann's graph as just one of many, but all the others do show that there was a medieval warm period, and quite an extensive one. However, what they try to show is that it wasn't quite as warm as the present, but they only get away with that by confining the analysis to the Northern Hemisphere, because temperatures in the Northern Hemisphere have risen much faster than temperatures in the Southern Hemisphere over the last 100 years. And therefore, in fact, the Northern Hemisphere temperature increase is 1.5 times as great as the global temperature increase. And that, of course, again, is a consequence of the urban heat island effect, among other things. But the fact is that if you chop off that extra amount of warming caused by the fact that they can find the analysis in the Northern Hemisphere, then even on the IPCC's new analysis, the medieval warm period was warmer than the present. As to how we stop people from pretending that the hockey stick graph was correctly compiled, well, you just have to refer them to McIntyre and McKittrick, 2005, in Geophysical Research Letters, who took it apart from top to bottom and showed what nonsense it is. There's a very good book by my learned friend and colleague Andrew Montford, who writes on the Bishop Hill website, on the hockey stick, that just come out, which is the definitive account of the whole story, a very, very good book. And in the end, I think what's going to stop this and other scare stories is, once we get the first global warming profiteer facing trial for racketeering at the instance of a credible prosecutor, preferably a state prosecutor, and I have been talking to one or two, we're working on that, and it looks as though there is now a case, certainly against Al Gore, certainly against Rajendra Pachauri, who's the current head of the IPCC's science climate panel, even though he himself is not a climatologist, but would you believe it, a railroad engineer. These people are now facing serious fraud charges and will eventually, I think, be prosecuted. And it will only take one prosecution before everybody who's been peddling this nonsense, whether in Greenpeace, or the World Wide Fund for Nature, or NASA, or GIS, or the NCBC, or the University of East Anglia, all these organizations, the moment they see that they can be prosecuted for fraudulent exaggeration of the science behind all this, they will run for cover and start to behave.
Excellent. Well, I just have to ask, what's next for Lord Monckton? Will you be at the Heartland Conference in Chicago in May?
Yes, I will, but before that I'm going to Bonn next week for the emergency UN conference to try to put the Copenhagen process back on track. I, of course, am going to try and make sure the Copenhagen process remains derailed, but I shall be there for that, to try and talk some sense into the delegates. Then I shall be going to the Tea Party rally in Washington, D.C. on the National Mall on the evening of April the 15th, which is Tax Day.
Uh-huh.
Now, I want everyone listening to this broadcast to make sure that they are there. That is going to be an amazing occasion, and I can just picture now President Obama cowering behind the drapes in the White House as millions assemble outside and tell him that while we are around, government of the people, by the people, and for the people shall not perish from the earth.
Wonderful. With that, I will say thank you for sharing so much of your Easter weekend with us. It's been a pleasure having you on. And next time I can tell, we're going to have to schedule it for the full hour.
Well, we certainly overrun somewhat this time. It's been a real delight, and I look forward to doing this again one day. And every success with your new venture. I hope it goes really well, and God bless America.
Thank you very much. Good day.
Bye.